This is NHL Radio.
Time now for NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Home Ice.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the NHL Hour. I'm Gary Bettman, and with me today, instead of Bill Clement, is Frank Brown, formerly of the Daily News and for the last decade, Group Vice President at the NHL. Mr. Clement sends his regrets. He's in Florida to do a game on the NHL Network, so he's on assignment and has been given the day off from us. We're coming to you live on NHL Home Ice, XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com. The call-in number is 1-877-645-6696. That's 1-877-645-6696. In addition to taking your calls, later in the show, we'll be joined by Executive Vice President and General Manager of the Montreal Canadiens, Bob Gainey, also a Hall of Famer, and somebody who is, in addition to being a great hockey mind, formerly great hockey player. He's done it all at all levels. He happens to be a really good guy. How are you, Frank?
I am just fine, thank you, and I'm excited. This weekend is the New York Marathon, even though I'm an alumnus of it. I'm sending best wishes to everybody who's going to run in it, and there is a little bit of a tie-in with regard to the fact that Bob Gainey, our guest later, ran the Boston Marathon in 2001 to raise funds for Hockey Fights Cancer.
I was waiting for you to get to the hockey tie-in. I didn't think we had given the show over to the Roadrunners Club for the week. We've actually, you know, as we reflect into the first month of the season, it's been a pretty good month. Four Thursdays ago, I seem to recall being in Prague, and then I went to Stockholm from there for the opening games. The Red Wings went to the White House. They hoisted their banner. We relaunched NHL.com, and Game Center Live made its debut. For those of you listening who haven't been to the new NHL.com, I urge you to do it, and please go to Game Center. It is the best streaming viewing experience I think anybody's ever seen, certainly for hockey. We think it's got great potential. USA Hall of Fame inducted this year's class, which was Mike Richter, Brian Leetch, Brett Hull, and Cammy Granato. We were at the Lester Patrick luncheon honoring Bob Nagley, Brian Burke, Phil Housley, and Ted Lindsay, and that took place in St. Paul, Minnesota. The general managers then met. Buffalo was awarded the 2011 World Junior Championships. We had last Saturday night 15 games, which meant that all of our teams were in action, and that's something that doesn't happen too frequently. This is Hockey Fights Cancer Month, which is a very important initiative. The league, for as long as I can remember, has been engaged in Hockey Fights Cancer. It's affected the NHL family, cancer that is, and we're doing everything we can to raise funds in support of fighting this terrible disease. In addition, by the way, there's a book that's now out called Reflections 2008. It's jointly presented by us and the NHLPA in conjunction with NHL Images and Getty Images, and it can be purchased online. Go to NHL.com. And then there are autographed copies from team captains, which can be bid on auction.nhl.com and nhlpa.com. In addition, Marty Brodeur continues his quest to be the winningest goaltender of all time. I think he needs 8 more wins. I was at the Rock last night. Not very often that I see the Devils play a game against anyone, let alone the Leafs, and have double-digit goals scored. And it was a close one for Marty, but he still needs 8. There's been a lot of discussion about the Doug Weight hit on Brandon Sutter, and we can talk about that later on. Some of the callers want. And we've moved the trading deadline one day to March 4th because March 3rd, the original date, actually had, I think, a dozen games scheduled, and we think it's better in terms of coverage and, more importantly, where players have to be if they get traded, to be on a day when we have less traffic in terms of the number of games, and we only have two games on March 4th. Mr. Brown, did I leave anything out?
Just some interesting starts. I thought I think Toronto's been off to a very, very interesting start under Ron Wilson, and the Rangers, of course, have started as a powerhouse, but I think there are some teams that we didn't expect possibly to start as well as they have who have done so. I think it's also a very, very interesting phenomenon to observe over the season in terms of coaches who are in their first season with a team. I, over the course of my newspaper career, learned that the first half, whether a new coach with his team wins all 41 or loses all 41, what you really learn about whether the guy has totally got control of his team is when you've got the when you see what he does in the second half and whether they make the playoffs. So for the teams or for the fans out there who are a little bit disheartened right now that things aren't going the way they may have expected, hang in there. And for the teams that for the fans of the teams who have started better than they thought.
Don't get your hopes up.
No. Let me say that this is a marathon, not a sprint.
Back to the connection. But the point you make also applies to, I think, teams that make fundamental changes with respect to players on the ice. I mean, Tampa's a very good example of a team that's made a lot of changes and probably didn't get off to the electrifying start that management and their fans would have hoped. But as the season progresses, and although that's also a case where there's a new coach as well.
Exactly.
It takes time, and you're right. It's way too early in the season for anybody to be drawing conclusions other than the fact that we've been seeing some really good games. Scoring is up. I think we're averaging either 5.9 or 6 goals a game, which is up from last year's 5.6 goals a game. What's also interesting is power play goals are down slightly. The increase in goal scoring is at even strength, and I'm not going to even offer any theories on why that might be, because it's too early in the season to do that, and you know the stats could change dramatically over the next few weeks. But those are things that we do keep an eye on. Why don't we start going to the phones, and let's take our first call. Dale in Los Angeles. This is Gary and Frank. You're on XM 204 and Sirius 208. How are you?
I'm doing fine, sir. How you doing?
Not too bad. What's going on?
Okay, my problem is that shot blocking, you guys think about changing to diving?
Well, actually, Bob Gainey is going to be the right one to talk about this, and I'll be sure to raise it with him. But his proposal, and I'm not even sure that it gets to the stage of being a proposal for a rule change, his discussion point at the general manager's meetings was we seem to be less – there seems to be less pucks getting through towards the net, that the goaltender has to be playing. The number of block shots is up fairly dramatically over the last few years. And his notion is instead of letting a player dive full out on the ice and getting an expanse, if you will, that exceeds 11 feet between the player laying out and the length of his stick, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to go all the way down. You have to have 1 foot, one blade on the ice. The brief discussion we had at the general manager's meeting was that, on the other hand, the block shots, the diving at pucks is a exciting play and fans like it. What we concluded was before we did any retooling of that rule, it would require much more extensive discussion. And when the general managers get together for 3 days in March, that will be on the agenda to discuss, not necessarily to make a change, but to at least have a discussion. And we're constantly reviewing all of the rules of the game. They're always up for discussion, not to change them, but just to make sure things are working the way that we would like. Next caller, Doug in Edmonton. You're on XM 204, Sirius 208. This is Gary, and Frank happens to be with me.
Hey, Commish. How are you?
We're doing okay. How
right
are you?
On. Good, good. Great season so far, I think. One of the better ones. Great start, that is. Just a couple of observations, though. I, for one, can't, for the life of me, understand why there needs to be an increase in scoring. A perfect example was the 1-0 game Boston and Edmonton the other night. It was, you know, the chances were there. The chances, to me, are almost as exciting as the goals. It was a pretty wide-open game. You know, that's the way I see it. I don't know what you guys are looking for, if you're looking for baseball scores or what, but that's just my opinion. And the second thing is the hits from behind. I think the league has to put the hammer down on these guys.
Let me both interesting points, and let me respond to them. We don't have a magic number in mind in terms of what goal scoring should be. I happen to agree with you that chances are more important than the number of goals that are actually scored. However, the trending in goal scoring gives us some indication of what's going on the ice, because one of the things that we do think is important in addition to chances is lead changes. What you don't want is a situation where the first goal scored in the game is the only scoring and the game is over, that there are no lead changes, that teams don't have a chance to come back. We'd like, even if a team's down by 2 or 3 goals going into the third period, we'd like to know that there's a chance that they can come back and that the play from a defensive standpoint isn't so stifling that there's no chance to mount a comeback. What comes to mind is, I think, the Stanley Cup final between Tampa Bay and Calgary. That 7-game series, interestingly enough, the first team that scored the goal in every game won the game. There was no change in momentum. There was no change in rhythm. The game was decided as soon as the first goal was scored. I agree with you, there can be great 1-0 games, but we look for chances, flow, lead changes, and scoring gives you an indication, if it's coming down, whether or not the dynamics of the game are such that maybe we're getting to a point where defense is dominating a little bit more than it should. It is merely one indication. There isn't a magic number where we sit around and throw darts and say, gee, we'd like 9 goals a game. That's not what it's about, because there can be good low-scoring games, 1-0 games. In addition to your second question, we don't like hits from behind. They're severely punished. They're discouraged, and supplemental discipline is meted out. I don't think there's been a whole lot of hitting from behind. It's not a penalty that we have to call very often. There's been a much greater debate recently on hits to the head, but hits from behind is something I think our players understand there's very little, if no tolerance for at all. Why don't we take our next caller, Pody in California. You're on XM 204, Sirius 208 with Gary and Frank.
Hi, it's Pogi, P-O-G-I.
The screen said P-O-D-I, so I apologize on behalf of the typist who's giving me bad information.
Hey, okay, no problem.
How you doing, Pogi?
Good. A couple of questions. First question was on that Super Saturday where every team played. The only game that wasn't televised was the Kings game, and unfortunately I'm the biggest Kings fan out there. And they were playing Nashville, and then the next Nashville game was against Washington, and it wasn't televised again. Is there a reason, or how do they pick which ones will be televised and won't be? And my second question, and I'll hang up and listen, is I'm big into hockey cards, and I know Upper Deck is pretty much the only one left, and I was wondering if there's any plans for the NHL to grant licenses to some of the other companies like Topps or Donruss.
Let me take the second question first. We have an exclusive deal with Upper Deck. It runs for another 2 seasons, and we know there's interest from some of the other trading card companies. A good friend of ours, Michael Eisner, now owns Topps, and I'm sure there'll be some interest from Topps in the future. But for the time being, we have an exclusive deal with Upper Deck, and that was largely dictated by the fact, and this applies to all sports, that the trading card industry went through some severe changes and difficulties, and as a result, there was real consolidation, and to keep the industry healthy, the best thing that we could do at the time was make an exclusive deal with Upper Deck. With respect to the schedule, Most teams have all of their games televised. There are a handful of teams that may only have 60 or 70 of their games televised locally. And as a result, they decide which of the games won't be carried. It's frequently a game that's on a road or scheduled against something else that the regional broadcaster may have not time for because they've got other program that they put in. We don't set the schedule for the local broadcast. We do it for the national broadcast. The clubs, by and large, do it locally in conjunction with their local broadcasters. Callers, stay on hold. We'll get back to your call soon. But when we come back, we will be joined by Executive Vice President and General Manager from the Montreal Canadiens, Bob Gainey. It's all coming up next on the NHL Hour on NHL Home Ice, XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com.
Hi, this is Mark Stahl. You're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now, back to Commissioner Bettman.
Go ahead. Welcome back to the NHL Hour. Gary Bettman here with Frank Brown. We'll get back to your calls shortly, but right now we have a very special guest on the line, Bob Gainey. Welcome to the NHL Hour.
Thank you, Commissioner. Nice to be with you.
It's always good to talk to you, my friend. Where in the world are you?
Well, today I'm in Binghamton, New York, just up the road from you.
And what are you doing in Binghamton? Our listeners are dying to know.
Well, it happens that I have a 29-year-old son who's a hockey player, and he's playing with a team out of Boise, Idaho this year, and they're playing just outside of Binghamton against the Elmira Jackals of the ECHL, so I'm here to see a game.
You're being a good dad, and I love that. Speaking of youth hockey, playing professionally when you're much younger, describe for people what it was like coming up in the Peterborough Petes organization, playing major junior in a town like Peterborough.
Well, Peterborough is really a manufacturing town, and so it was a very stable environment where families were settled and work days were designed around shift work. So kids were always able to get to their activities, baseball or lacrosse, and particularly ice hockey. And at that time, the NHL had just given up their feeder systems because of the expansion in 1967. And the Peterborough Petes had been a feeder team for the Montreal Canadiens. And so with the draft being implemented in 1967, the rules had changed, and so I started with the Petes around 1970, and the rules at that time were if you live within a 50-mile radius of a team that had a Canadian Hockey League team or a major junior team, you were the property of that team. So growing up in Peterborough, I had one option, and that was to find my way onto the Peterborough Petes, which I was able to do. It was very comfortable because at the games, I was like playing youth hockey because I knew everybody in the rink, including my parents and family and school friends. So it was a very comfortable way for me to continue playing competitively without having the disruptions that a lot of other kids had, which was moving away from home at the age of 16 or 17 and living in billeted with a family in that community.
Did it make your transition to the NHL a little more difficult because having not had the experience of billeting and being on the road as much, did you find it more startling when you went to Montreal?
Yes, very much. I was very green in most of life skills. As we all were at that time, there weren't the programs in place now that the kids have where they're shipped off to national programs or under 17 or under 18 training camps. We were very green, and really very few of the players graduating from the Canadian Hockey League at that time were really ready to play with the pros. I think the kids today are much better prepared and much better organized, like in their life skills as well as their hockey skills, to come right into the NHL and enjoy playing and be a good productive player for their team.
You played, you were coached by Roger Nielsen and Scotty Bowman. You played on a team run by the legendary Sam Pollock. Based on what you have accomplished as a player, as a general manager, what did you take away from those three gentlemen, and in what ways were they similar and different?
Well, Roger was a school teacher, and he had a lot of structure, but he had an enormous amount of energy. His days were long and full. He taught school full-time as well as coached the team in Peterborough while I was there, and scouted. And so I learned a lot from Roger about work ethic and about kind of prioritizing what was important. And the one coincidence is that Roger had been a scout for the Montreal Canadiens. So Scott Bowman and Roger and Sam Pollock were all known to each other. And so moving to Montreal, there were a lot of similarities in the Montreal organization. It was like moving from an A organization to a AAA organization. And many of the characteristics and traditions and principles in the Montreal organization in the early 1970s were left over from the 50s and 60s, and things that had been built in by Mr. Irvin and Toe Blake and Frank Selke and those organizers or builders from a generation before. And so I got to tap into those, and frankly, I'm still using them today. And they seem to work today. They have to be shifted so that they meet today's geography or the generation that's here. But most of the things that I was asked to do and sometimes made to do are things that often will still apply and be effective and help a player be a good player today.
You were a general manager in Minnesota, Dallas, and now in Montreal. Three pretty different markets from a hockey standpoint. Does that change what you think you need to do or how you conducted yourself as a general manager?
I don't think so, Gary. The way I view the different franchises, because we're spread from Southern California all the way to the Northeast and Montreal and upper Alberta. Each place has its own puzzle, and part of the puzzle are pieces that fit in easily, and part of the puzzle are pieces that don't fit in easily. Nobody has a perfect puzzle. Looking from the outside, you can assume that some place has got it easier than another, or that another place has more difficulties or an unsolvable puzzle, but it's really not the case. And I think if every manager or every person working in Atlanta or Los Angeles or Calgary, if they concentrate on their own puzzle and use the things that are already in place that are positive, that they can rely on, that work for them, and then not be disappointed at the things that are difficult that they have to solve, but see them as challenges, then every place can be successful, and each place can have its own identity and its own character, and it can be a really good part of each of those communities.
We're talking to Bob Gainey, Executive Vice President and General Manager of the Montreal Canadiens. You captained the Canadiens, I believe, for 8 seasons. What does it take to be a good captain?
Well, I think it takes probably being able to be yourself and still show good example and have an instinct for when a solid word or a directive to some of your teammates or just being able to pull up previous experiences and how they turned out well and pass them on to the group you're with, to take an experience that didn't turn out well and be able to warn people about that. So I think it's really being one of the group, but using whatever tools you have to help the players around you accomplish their goals and to be as good as they can be and to have a really great time playing in the NHL. We all know it doesn't last long. It doesn't last forever. and to look at it not with that kind of view, but that it's a privilege and that you really need to take advantage of it and put everything into it while the opportunity exists.
When you talk about it never lasting forever, obviously from a player's standpoint, that's true. But you've made a very smooth transition to the front office. Was that an objective you had when you were playing, or did it just sort of happen by coincidence when you were done playing?
Well, I always liked thinking about the other aspects of what made up our teams. And even as far as, you know, I was curious about, you know, what was the responsibility of the equipment trainers and what were all the things that fell under their responsibility? And so all the different things that I could recognize that we weren't, as players, we weren't there alone. We needed other support groups around us to help us get to the rink and get on the ice and compete as well as we could. So I did have some curiosity that made me understand that there was more to getting a game started than the players just showing up.
Who was responsible for your transition into management? How did your first opportunity come about?
Well, I left Montreal in 1989 as a player, not really knowing what I wanted to do. And at that point, Serge Savardi was the manager, would have taken me in and allowed me to, you know, to find some place in the organization. I felt that they had a really strong group. All their scouting staff was in place. They had a good coach in Pat Burns at the time. Serge was there as the manager. And so I opted to take a sideways move, and I ended up in France with a medium-level team there. But the job description was a complete job description of everything from coaching the team to coaching the kids, to finding somebody to flood the ice surface. And so the management part started right there. And when I got to Minneapolis in 1990, the team had closed its doors and locked up. And so we started to build that franchise, which stayed there for another 3 years from scratch again. And so you learn a lot when you're able to start with nothing and put it all together. Into Dallas, a similar type of situation where we had to go into a non-hockey market, an unfamiliar market, and put together our medical staff, our training staff, somebody to take statistics, find out who was going to make the ice, a practice arena, travel schedules. And so I had good opportunities to learn in situations. I mean, I was fortunate with the expansion in the 1990s. People like me got opportunities to get into those positions that are not easy to get into. And I had my chance to do that in places like Minneapolis and Dallas, where the flaws that were in my work or the mistakes that I made didn't get the same kind of scrutiny that they get in Montreal or Vancouver or Toronto or Philadelphia or New York. So I had a little on-the-job training that wasn't as severely judged as some of the other people.
I have a question, Bob. The 1970, the late 1970 teams that won the Stanley Cup, among your teammates were Mario Tremblay, Doug Risebrough, and Jacques Lemaire. And I just wondered, since you're playing Minnesota tonight, and those three guys are the management team of the Wild, number one, looking back to the late 70s, could you have imagined that the four of you would be in the positions that you're in now? Which of them was the greatest surprise? And when you play each other, what is the emotion like for you?
Well, we don't play each other very often, but going into the game tonight, I think, my first thought would be, we're going to play against a team that's really well coached and really well organized. And when I think about Mario, I think we're going to play against a team that will have a lot of emotion. And if I think about Jacques Lemaire, then I know they're going to play intelligently. They're going to play with a lot of thought into how they try to maneuver the game in their direction and then finally put it in the bag. And with Doug Risebrough, I think it's just he's smart in guts. Doug is a very hard competitor, and don't be fooled by that little grin and that little smile he has, because he is that kind of person. But when he rolls up his sleeves, he wants to win. So it'll be a great matchup tonight. I think we have a good team to play against the Wild. And could I have thought that those all of those people from those 70s teams would still be involved in the NHL? I don't think so. I know Guy Lapointe is still working with the Wild right now. And Larry Robinson is over in New Jersey with the Devils. There's still a few of those guys left. But I see it as there was a similar situation that happened in the late 60s and early 70s when expansion happened in the NHL. And as the new teams in Pittsburgh and Minneapolis and Oakland and those areas were looking for someone to guide them, they looked to the teams from the 50s and 60s in the NHL and who were the successful players from those teams. And many of those guys ended up working in the NHL in the early 1970s. And our group that graduated in the late 80s walked right into an expansion period in the 1990s. So I think that's part of the reason. And just as we were able to find a way to win games and championships in the 1970s when we were given a chance, to get involved in coaching or management or scouting in the 1990s, we found a way to keep our spot in those places too.
We're talking to Bob Gainey, Executive VP and General Manager of the Canadian. Bob, a couple of questions, then we're going to let you go, if that's okay. You brought up for discussion at the last General Manager's meeting a rule change relative to how shots are blocked. I got a call about this at the beginning of the show, and I probably wasn't as articulate on the point as you can be, so why don't you share with the listeners what your thinking is?
Well, my suggestion was to the group to consider the possibility of having a rule that would require the players to keep at least one skate on the ice, which would mean that the sliding block that we see now, whether it's to block a pass or block a slide, would become an illegal play. And the purpose of that suggestion, it was to create some dialogue. And I know that in our group that there would be a lot of different opinions on it. But I think when I prioritize the things that I like to see earned scoring chances. I like to see great saves, and I like to see goals. And I think that this change would allow more scoring chances, possibly more goals, or if not more goals, good saves. And it is more difficult today for the puck to find its way through the maze of players with their size and their defensive patterns in their defensive zone. The efficiency and effectiveness of the equipment that they wear, it's more difficult for pucks to get through to the net. And this suggestion, I believe, would make it easier for more shots attempted to become shots on net.
And as I told the listeners, and as we discussed at the managers' meeting, this is something that's going to get further discussion at the March meetings. Last question for you. There's probably no more passionate hockey market than Montreal. Do you relish the scrutiny that you and the team get? Do you deal with it? Do you hate it? How does it feel to one who's up there all the time where hockey is clearly a religion like no other?
Well, I really enjoy it. I have to admit that even though my personality is one that's a little bit withdrawn and I'm not a really open out there personality, I love the fact that the people enjoy the sport so much. They're passionate about it. They care about it. There's nothing that gets left unturned. And occasionally it goes over the top, and then, you know, I just pull back and realize that it is hockey, it's sport, and it's not everything. But in many of the experiences I've had in Montreal in the 15, 16 years as a player and now 5 or 6 years in management, we've had so many great nights there where the people have enjoyed themselves. And I mean, we hope to have many more. We hope to have playoff wins, and we'd love to have championships. But the people really enjoy it, and it's what hockey and sports is about. The NHL is about the players and the fans. And when the fans are happy and they leave the rink and they've been able to leave all their other stuff behind for 3 or 4 hours and they go home feeling good, with something common and positive to talk about, that is what, you know, you can absorb a lot to be in that kind of, to be absorbed in that kind of atmosphere.
Bob, enjoy your time with your son. Good luck with the Canadians this season. And thank you very much for joining us on the NHL Hour. We're going to take a very short break, and when we return, we'll get right back to your calls. All on the NHL Hour on NHL Home Ice, XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com.
Hi, this is Jonathan Toews with the Chicago Blackhawks, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now, back to Commissioner Bettman.
Welcome back to the NHL Hour. This is Gary Bettman, along with Frank Brown, who's filling in for Bill Clement. The call-in number again is 1-877-645-6696, 877-645-6696. 6696. Let's get back to the calls. Paul in Toronto, you're on XM 204, Sirius 208 with Frank and Gary.
Good afternoon, Mr. Bettman. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm actually calling for two reasons, and the first one is probably to grovel a little bit, because I'm calling to give you an apology. A number of years ago, I was on a Toronto radio station calling, and kind of sat there, as a number of people did way back when you first started, talked about how you weren't the right guy for the job. And since I've been able to, you know, have home ice and center ice and really see what kind of game is out there once you step outside Toronto, you know what, we probably have the best game that we've had for a long time. So I just wanted to apologize to you that that probably that wasn't the right thing. And you're doing a great job with the league. The game is great. And the second thing I wanted to chat about, because it only comes up when we have an incident, and it comes up for a while, and you know, somebody eventually is going to get seriously hurt in our league, and the people have been hurt in other leagues, and that's to go to no-touch icing. I can't think of a single reason why we wouldn't have no-touch icing in the NHL, and I'll hang up and listen to you.
Well, first of all, thank you for calling in. There is no need to either grovel or apologize. We're glad you're a fan and that you're enthused about the game. And I must tell you, I love what I do, and it's gratifying to hear people feel good about the game. That, to me, is the most important thing. That's why we're in business. That's why this game is what it is. It's because of the fans. With respect to no-touch icing, it's something that's been a matter of pretty good debate over the years. I think overwhelmingly it's the sentiment of our managers, our coaches, and our players that having the prospect of the puck streaming down the ice and everybody standing around to watch it, as opposed to having what could be an exciting play. We've seen instances where a team has avoided icing and gotten the shot on net, gotten a goal. We even had a Stanley Cup final game, and I'm having trouble remembering the series, where it actually turned the game around because of the scoring chance it created. It is an exciting play, and it is better. There aren't very many injuries on an icing play, but it does happen, and when they do happen, they have been fairly devastating because the speed at which the two players who are vying for the puck are approaching the boards. Having said that, we did make a change this year in the interpretation of our rules, whereby you can't be playing the body on an icing play. You must be playing the puck. And if you play the body, you will get penalized, and you may be liable for supplemental discipline, if particularly if there's an injury. So what we think we've done is taken a step forward to eliminate the possibility of injuries by making sure that, you know, guys aren't having their legs cut out from under them, they're not knocked off balance at the last second, but rather there's a genuine battle for the puck that's going on. And, you know, knock on wood, so far so good this season. We think that that was a sensible, effective change, and it's something that the managers, in conjunction with the competition committee, came up with, and I know it's something that the players are now comfortable with. Let's assume and hope that it holds up. But those were both appreciative I'm appreciative of the comments in both regards and the question. Robert in the Bronx, you're on XM 204, Sirius 208 with Frank and Gary.
Hi, Commissioner. First of all, thanks for coming out to The Rock last night. I hope you enjoyed our wonderful arena.
It's a great arena.
Any word of the All-Star game?
Not yet. We've got a long list of applicants. It isn't something that I've had a recent discussion with the Devils about, but I think as Newark continues to revitalize and they build more hotels and we see the continuation of the progress that's been made in that city, I wouldn't rule anything out.
My question is regarding last Saturday's infamous smoke bomb incident. Is the league doing anything on its end to make sure that nothing like this happens again?
Well, we obviously, and what Robert is referring to is at the tail end of the game in Philadelphia on Saturday night, somebody threw a flare on the ice, and it gave off the requisite smoke that flares give off. Completely unacceptable. We have pretty extensive security procedures with respect to people bringing things into the building and the like. We are reviewing how this got in. The person who threw the flare, I am told, immediately ran out of the building. We have videotape of the person, and we are trying to track him or her down. I think it was a him, is what I was told from the quick review of the videotape, and it's completely unacceptable. And we believe that when our fans come into a building, they're entitled to a safe, fun environment, the players as well. And this type of activity will not be tolerated. By and large, overwhelmingly, our fans are great. They conduct themselves superbly in our arenas. But we do have a great deal of effort and energy spent on security procedures to make sure our environment's safe. And I hope not to see anything like that ever again, because it's unfortunate, and it's not fair to everybody else who's in that arena, especially and including the fans and the players. Karina in Columbus, you're
Hi,
on. How are you? You're on XM 204.
Thanks.
Well, okay, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
I'm excited to talk to you as well.
All right. I just have a question about the goal review protocol.
Sure.
It's to my understanding that if a goal gets scored, the on-ice official either points to the net or he waves his arms regardless. So say, for example, he points to the net, and if the goal is disputable, then they go to Toronto. And if that goal is then deemed inconclusive in Toronto, the on-ice call stands. Is that correct?
Pretty much, but let me give you the caveat, and I think I know what you're talking about. If the puck goes in the net, there'll be a signal that there's a goal because the puck is in the net. But if, for example, one of the other officials on the ice thinks that it was a high stick, by way of example, he may decide that notwithstanding the puck being in the net, that the puck, the goal should not count. And I think this is what happened in the incident you're referring to. They went back to Toronto to review it, and it was inconclusive. The fact that it was inconclusive meant that because the ruling on the ice by the other officials was that it was a high stick, it was no goal. One of the things they were trying to do, and it's a matter of considerable debate internally, is I would like the fans in the arena to get as fulsome an experience as you can get on television with respect to the explanation as to what's going on. But over the PA system, it's not as easy to give the explanation that I just gave to you. So in the attempt to try and explain over the PA system in Columbus what happened, the explanation didn't seem as consistent with what actually transpired in going through the video review process. And the question that we're debating internally is, are we raising more problems and more concerns by giving partial explanations, by trying to inform the arena, and are we better off just signaling goal or no goal? And if we have more incidents like the one we had where we created confusion, they got the call right. It was a high stick in the official's view, and it was inconclusive on review, so we disallowed the goal. But if we have more situations where by trying to explain it to the fans in the building, we're creating more confusion, we're going to have to take another look at the announcing practice. But they did get the procedure right in that case. Dave in Nova Scotia, you're on Sirius 208 and XM 204 with Gary and Frank.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling in.
Just a little tie-in with your last guest, Bob Gainey. We got the All-Star Game coming back to Montreal this year.
On the 100th anniversary of the Montreal Canadiens, a centennial. Think about that. The Canadiens are older than the NHL.
Oh, that's great. And my question is, I'd like to take my son up to Montreal. They're probably going to get a chance to buy any tickets, or they all go to the advertisers and sponsors?
Well, first and foremost, they go to the season ticket holders in Montreal. As you would expect, there is a long list of season ticket holders. My guess is, if you keep an eye on it, there may be some modest public sale of some tickets. And so keep your eyes on that. You know, put yourself on a list with the Montreal Canadiens. But it's not a question of us just giving them all the sponsors. Yes, we have some sponsors and guests that we entertain, but overwhelmingly, the tickets are going to go to the fans who support the Canadiens night in and night out.
Okay, that's great. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. Tom in Boston, you're on XM 204, Sirius 208 with Gary and Frank.
Hey, Mr. Bettman. Thanks for taking my call. I want to commend you on the way you've marketed the league in the past couple of years with not only this radio show, but the television network as well. I think it's been a real good thing. Quick comment or question about players that are under contract in the NHL or AHL leaving those contracts and going to the Russian Federation League. I think that's happening and has happened. I'm just wondering if you're in negotiations with them at all to have some type of agreement in place so that may not happen in the future.
It's a great question, and let me try and answer it as best I can. For over a decade, we had a transfer agreement with the International Ice Hockey Federation governing the transfer of players from the European and Russian leagues to the NHL. Basically, we paid a number of millions of dollars to the International Ice Hockey Federation, and players during certain times of the year who were drafted by NHL teams, those NHL teams could take the players even if they had existing contracts in Europe and Russia. In return for which, as well, our contracts were respected by those various leagues and federations. Starting about 3 years ago, the Russians decided they no longer wanted to participate in a transfer agreement. They just decided they didn't like the fact that their players were coming to the NHL to play, which was a harsh reality for many of their players, because the best players in the world do want to come to play in the NHL.
Right.
We nevertheless entered into a transfer agreement with the IIHF that covered all the other federations, and that worked pretty well for the first couple of years coming back from the work stoppage. This past season, all of the federations decided not to have a transfer agreement, and the Russians started signing players, Radulov being the most notable, who are under contract to the NHL. We've tried to have negotiations a number of times with the Continental League, spelt with a K, the successor to the former Russian Super League. And each time we get to the point where we say we're going to respect each other's contract, they then go and take one of our players who's under contract, either a player like Radulov, who's NHL caliber, and in his case he played for 2 years in the NHL, or players who are under two-way contracts and are being sent down and are leaving in violation of those contracts to play in Russia. This will ultimately sort itself out, but at the present time we're not in a position to have an agreement with the KHL, because there seems to be no respect for contracts that even they acknowledge exist, and we're going to have to just continue to work our way through this. It's very difficult to negotiate with someone or an entity that doesn't respect contracts and seems to be making up the rules as they go along. I do expect, though, that after this season or before this season ends, we will have an ongoing agreement, transfer agreement, again with the other federations, because we think that's the best thing for international hockey, to make sure there's peace and harmony and cooperation. The Russians seem to be out on their own right now, and we don't think it's good for hockey anywhere, including in Russia. Let's go to another caller. Michael in Florida, you're on with Frank and Gary. This is XM 204 and Sirius 208.
Hi, Gary. How are you this afternoon?
I'm okay. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. A couple of quick things.
Got to tell you, you know, the players, and I've told you this before, are just wonderful. They have not forgotten who this is all about. Just to give you an example, my 11-year-old son and I, and a friend of his whose birthday was, were at the Tampa Bay Lightning Hurricanes game a couple of weeks ago. And when they came off the ice for practice, Cam Ward threw my son Puck, who was wearing his Lightning jersey, and my son promptly turned around and gave it to his friend for his birthday. And after the first period, as the Hurricanes were down 2-0, they could not have been feeling very good going into the dressing room. Rod Brind'Amour comes off the ice, looks at my son with his Lightning jersey, smiles up at him, and threw him the first period puck. What a gentleman this guy is. What a great bunch of players we got. I just can't say enough about them. They just remember their roots.
Well, that's nice of you to say. We are extremely proud of our players and the way they conduct themselves both on and off the ice. Mike in River Falls, Wisconsin, you're on XM 204, Sirius 208 with Frank and Gary.
How you doing, Gary?
I'm okay. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Great night of hockey tonight, Minnesota and Montreal. What a great game that's going to be.
We're all looking forward to it. And, in fact, there is a free preview on Game Center Live on NHL.com tonight. So for those of you who want to see the new technology, please go to it. Anyway, what can I do for you?
I had a question about expansion.
3 minutes.
There's talk about maybe an expansion team going to maybe Kansas City. I don't agree with that one. Las Vegas, I could see that. But what about Milwaukee, Wisconsin? I just can't believe that the state of Wisconsin doesn't have a pro hockey team. And I would just kind of like to get your thought on that.
Fair question. Expansion is not on our radar screen right now in terms of engaging in any formal process. We'd prefer not to be relocating any franchises, and we hope that will continue to be the case. We're not ready to engage in any formal expansion process. There are lots of places that have expressed an interest in having a team, and if we get to the point where we're prepared to formally consider those expressions of interest, then we'll open it up and we'll see who's interested. And the three criteria you look at under those circumstances are ownership, market, and arena. And if Milwaukee has someone who wants to own a team, if there's a prospect of a new arena, because my understanding is Milwaukee needs one, and the market makes sense. I don't know. I haven't been following how the Bucks do. I don't know if that market's big enough to support a second team. Obviously, if there's an application filed when we're going through the process, it would get serious consideration. But as I said, right now, that's not a process that we're engaging in. And as I said, even though we're not engaging in it, it hasn't stopped the rumor mills. There's no shortage of speculation that we're going to Vegas, Seattle, Kansas City, Ontario. You name it, it's been suggested, speculated about, and I urge everyone not to get too wrapped up in all that speculation, because I can tell you right now, there isn't anything to it. Frank, anything you want to add before we wrap up?
Just that there are three Hockey Fights Cancer-themed games tonight, and it's Tampa at Buffalo, the game we discussed earlier, also Montreal at Minnesota, and also Pittsburgh at Phoenix. Great cause. Get out to the rink and enjoy it.
This has been the NHL Hour. Thanks for joining us. Coming up next is In the Slot with Phil Esposito. We'll be back next Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Until then, have a great week, and thanks for calling in.
Hi, this is Bruce Boudreau of the Washington Capitals. The hockey season never ends around here. This is NHL Home Ice.
For more podcasts, check out NHL.com. This is NHL Radio.